Welcome to this month's episode of Don't Miss a Beat. I'm Dr. Stephen Green. I'm here with my friend and colleague, Dr. Muthu Vadakanathan, and we're here at the American Heart Association meeting. It's been a fantastic meeting here in New Orleans. A lot of incredible science being presented, including in the cardiovascular kidney metabolic space. So one of the key trials that will be presented at the AHA 2025 this year is by our good friend, Dr. Ambrish Pani, who's an associate professor, clinical investigator at University of Texas Southwestern. And it's called the Poly-HF trial. We're privileged to have Dr. Pandey joining us today.
Thanks, Steve, for having me. And it's been a great meeting so far. So looking forward to talking about our study results today.
Absolutely. So, poly pills have been, increasingly discussed across all these different fields of cardiovascular medicine. We oftentimes think about them for primary and secondary prevention of ASCVD and hypertension. But, from the heart failure space, as we're talking about more and more pillars of GDMT and we're talking about goals of maximizing adherence, the poly pill has actually been increasingly discussed as, hey, why don't we have this for HFrEF? And now we have kudos to Dr. Pandey here for leading the Poly-HF trial, which is trying to get at exactly that, a poly pill for HFrEF.
Yeah, I think the concept of poly pill has been there for a while, and it has been tested a lot in low-middle-income countries as a strategy for prevention and as a public health strategy. More recently, as you know, the SECURE trial tested it in secondary prevention strategy and showed really good evidence in favor of polypill for reducing adverse clinical outcomes. The heart failure space is a little more challenging. There's much more nuanced management. There are multiple therapies. These patients are at higher risk of adverse effects, and you have to titrate. So the heart failure committee had generally not accepted the polypill approach, and that was the incentive for us to test this hypothesis, because when SECURE came out, we were like, why not test it for HFrEF? And truly, there is a clinical equipoise whether this will be beneficial or whether this would lead to not as much acceptance because of the nuances related to uptitration, treatment intensification, and a lot of the personalized care that these heart failure patients receive.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a fan of it because I've also talked about rapid sequence simultaneous initiation or GDMTs for HFrEF, including, focusing at least on low doses at the start. And I've always think like conceptually, like a poly pill would be a great way to check all the boxes right away. But walk us through the Poly-HF trial. You kind of talked about some of the upstream thought processes and everything, but how did you design the trial and some of the nuances there?
Yeah, I think so. When we were designing the trial, there was a lot of momentum in the community about this rapid sequencing of therapies, and strong HF was on the horizon. And I think there was a general consensus in the community of heart failure doctors that we need to get our patients on these medicines sooner. And I think having all classes at the same time is better than waiting to uptitrate one and then start another. So we were basically taking a leaf out of that book, and we designed the Poly-HF trial as a randomized control study, where we enrolled patients who had heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, with ejection fraction less than 40%, who were not on target optimal or target doses of the quad therapy, which is ARNIs or ACE inhibitors and beta blocker and SGLT2 inhibitor and a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist. The idea was we will test the hypothesis of whether a polypill-based approach to GDMT intensification and management can lead to better outcomes in form of improvement in left ventricle ejection fraction, which was our primary outcome assessed by cardiac MRI. And then also we did an exploratory analysis for secondary endpoints like clinical events for heart failure hospitalization or ED visits, quality of life improvement. And also one of the unique things that we wanted to test, which has not been tested to that extent in the polypill literature, is improvement in adherence. And a lot of the adherence literature that you see in polypill space and otherwise comes from self-reported adherence, which is not as, I think, rigorous assessment. So we wanted to get more objective in adherence assessment and differences by polypill versus usual care. So we did therapeutic drug monitoring for the components in the polypill and tested them in the usual care arm as well, measuring the blood levels of beta blockers and spironolactone metabolites to see and confirm adherence to therapies and see whether truly polypill makes a difference in adherence of these adherence for patients for these therapies.
Fantastic. Congratulations on completing the trial. For one, as you said, this has been a notion that's been around in heart failure for a long time, but this is really pioneering work, and it's probably one of the first randomized control trials of a polypill in heart failure. Now, talk to us about the mechanics a little bit about the trial, including how you created a polypill. What does that mean functionally? And in addition, with any implementation trial, we have to understand a bit about the follow-up scheme and how you structured visits. Of course, you have follow-up MRI as a primary endpoint, but during the trial, was there structured visits in which titration was a focus, or was this left to usual clinical practice and usual clinicians, clinical care provided by clinicians?
Yeah, I think those are really important aspects of any study, and we were very thoughtful about how we would conduct it, because any strategy trial ultimately comes down to the details of what happens as part of that strategy. So we had a pretty protocolized approach to the whole thing. So starting with the polypill manufacturing, which is a big hurdle in adoption of polypills in the US. I think we have had several effective polypill trials in different disease domains, but the uptake in US has been very low because of the regulatory challenges and the challenges of scaling and partnership with pharma. So what we did was we took an approach which took out a lot of these challenges by creating an encapsulation-based polypill. So what we did was we took the individual pills and we put it in a capsule in the pharmacy, and then we dispensed it. So the pharmacy could dispense and encapsulate the polypills and dispense it. And we got an FDA IND exempt because we're not truly changing the structure of the guideline-approved medications. So that was one approach that helped us avoid the hurdle of the pharma and the regulatory approvals. And then when we were implementing the study, we didn't want to do a study where the usual care is not great and that's why your intervention looks good, because we know that uptake of evidence-based therapies in the usual care is low. Like only 15% patients get onto all four classes of guideline-directed medical therapy for heart failure. So we had an intentional approach to uptitration of therapies. So we had patients seen at baseline, then 1 month, 3 months, and 6 months. And the idea was that at each visit, we would uptitrate the medications to reach to the optimal dosage, which is 50% of the target dose that is tolerated. And we had this followed for polypill as well as for the usual care. So we called it the enhanced usual care because we're trying to follow like a strong HF, like more rapid uptitration of medications. And you will see in our results that we had a much higher rates of optimal and any dose or therapy use across both arms.
I mean, before we get to the results, I want to ask a question about the patient population, because I was reading through your JCF design paper with the baseline characteristics. And, you know, in most, you know, clinical trials of a new pharmaceutical, for example, we, you know, use enrichment criteria, and we talk about, you know, NT-proBNP criteria, and we're trying to enrich for downstream clinical events. But here you're trying to enrich for people who might really take advantage of this extra adherence they might get from a polypill. And I noticed like some of the social determinants of health in terms of the patient population, you know, seem to be enriched for people that, again, could potentially benefit for something that would improve adherence, and wanted to give you a chance to talk about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I work at UT Southwestern, and our primary teaching hospital is a safety net hospital, Parkland Hospital, where the majority of the patients were enrolled from. And I trained there and I've been taking care of patients with heart failure there. So a lot of the origin of this idea was to create an intervention that can be implemented for patients who need it the most. And our patients who have a socioeconomic disadvantage and come from socially disadvantaged backgrounds have the biggest hurdles in going to see to physicians in getting therapies and in being able to adhere to the therapies because of several challenges. They have high burden of polypharmacy. So we wanted to have our patient population in the study be reflective of the patients who are most in need of such a therapy. So we ended up enrolling patients predominantly from our safety net hospital. We also had a part of our study population come from the university hospital. But overall, we had more than 50% self-reported Black participants in the study, and over 30% self-reported Hispanic ethnicity participants. 30% of our participants spoke Spanish as their primary language. And all these factors count towards the challenges that patients face with respect to their GDMT uptitration, and we wanted to see whether this intervention can actually work in this setting. And if it works in this setting, I think it's addressing a need in the most vulnerable patient population.
Super. And one of the pushbacks to polypills has always been the challenge related to titration. And you are offering multiple polypills based on beta blocker dosing What did you do with the other doses of the other medicines, including RAS inhibitors, and were you using fixed doses of the other medicines?
So that's a great question, and I think I'll give you a little bit of a background on what the polypill structure, the composition looked like. So the polypill included three of the four GDMT classes. So we had a beta blocker with metoprolol XL in multiple dosages, starting from 25 to 150. Then we had MRA at 12.5 fixed dose, and then we had SGLT2 inhibitor with empagliflozin at 10. So ARNIs, which are now class 1 recommended drugs from the RAS inhibitor side, for HFrEF was kept outside and not part of the polypill because it's twice a day. And we wanted the polypill to be once a day medication. If we are creating an intervention for improving adherence, twice a day was a little bit not ideal. So we had to do some trade-offs. So we kept the ARNIs out, and then the polypill had beta blocker, SGLT2 and MRA. You and I have debated a lot about what's the best titration strategy and where do you get most return on investment from up-titrating medications. And we know that from literature, the most return on investment in terms of improving cardiac function is from beta blockers. SGLT2 inhibitors are a fixed-dose recommended therapy. MRAs can be 12.5 or 25, and traditionally we start at 12.5 and we go up to 25, but we kept at 12.5, one, to lower the risk of hyperkalemia, because if you stopped one drug, then you have to stop the whole polypill. So we wanted to balance this, and there is literature evidence from Rails trial that the hyperkalemia risk is a lot lower, even though the benefits are much much greater with 12.5 compared to 25. And so that's why we wanted to have the trade-off of side effects and also the pill size. And then we wanted to make sure the pill is palatable enough that the patients take it. And so that's how the composition of the polypill ended up being.
Excellent. Shall we roll into results?
Let's roll. Yeah. Honest, Dr. Pandey.
Yeah. So first of all, we completed the study with a 6-month follow-up. The primary outcome of the study was LV ejection fraction improvement from baseline to follow-up using cardiac MRI. And then the secondary outcome included clinical endpoints of heart failure hospitalization or ED visits as a recurrent event, and quality of life improvement and adherence by therapeutic drug monitoring. And we had a hierarchical composite clinical endpoint to assess it all. So we had 212 participants in our study, randomized in a 1-to-1 fashion across the two arms. Overall, I think 187 participants had a completed 6-month baseline and follow-up MRIs done, and of which 3 patients had recovered their EF by the baseline MRI because they had tachycardia and used cardiomyopathy or something. So they did not have low EF at the time of start of the baseline MRI study. So in the 184 participants who had low EF at the time of baseline and completed follow-up, we saw a significantly higher follow-up ejection fraction among the polypill arm participants compared to the usual care after accounting for their baseline measures. And the absolute difference in the ejection fraction was 3.4%. We also saw a significant difference in the rates of recurrent heart failure hospitalization and ED visits. And the recurrent event hazard ratio was, I think, 0.50, so around 50% lower overall burden of heart failure hospitalization or ED visits. We also saw a significant difference in the quality of life. So polypill participants had a 8-point higher quality of life on follow-up compared to the usual care participants. And we were really interested in the adherence data because that is the mechanism, because you're using the same drugs, and we really wanted to make sure that we are assessing the adherence in the gold standard way. And based on the therapeutic drug monitoring data, we saw 50% higher adherence to all meds that were tested in the polypill arm compared to the usual care arm. We also looked at the data on the uptake of the quadruple therapy at any dose and at optimal doses. And we saw there was a 30% difference in the uptake of optimal dose quadruple GDMT in the favor of polypill arm. So the uptake increased in both arms, but the polypill arm, we were able to get to like high 90% rates of uptake as compared to around, I think, for any dose, and around, I think, 70% for the usual care arm. And at optimal doses, that was like 40% versus 70% or something.
Wow. I mean, super impressive results. And again, big congratulations.
Thanks.
I think, you know, it goes well with what we already know a lot about, you know, time to optimal clot therapy being such an important feature. And I think this really complements, you know, strong HF for a lot of the key themes. You know, one of the things that, you know, trying to understand the mechanism of how you had these, you know, tremendous results, including, you know, the 3% increase in EF compared to placebo, and also the, you know, very impressive hazard hazard ratio reduction for the worsening heart failure events. You talked about the adherence being better. I'm just curious from your perspective, from the clinical trial perspective, you know, we always talk about in a regular randomized trial, like let's say a new pharmaceutical drug, you know, you do a randomized trial and you have 100% exposure in one arm versus 0% versus placebo. And you have that delta try to go after a hard clinical endpoint. And here we had MRI. But how do you think about, you know, from a trial design perspective, the delta you would need in different GDMT exposures in the two groups to try to go after those clinical endpoints?
And just to put that question into context, I will be completely honest, Ambrish, I was pessimistic about the study, mostly because you designed it with such a strong usual care arm, and that's unusual for implementation trials. And so kudos to you and your co-investigators, because you set a very, very high bar for yourself in this implementation trial, in which not only is the usual care arm receiving all components that is included in the polypill, but you have structured follow-up in which they are optimized even beyond what is offered in usual clinical practice. And all that would have, to me, placed us at a point where maybe these arms are quite similar, but you're seeing quite a striking difference. So is it sufficient to explain the results?
Yeah, I think we wanted to test it against the usual care that is a fair comparison. I think a lot of the criticism of polypill literature, including some of the really positive studies, has been that the usual care does not even get close to the same kind of care, and it basically biases the study to be positive because it's a difference in quality of care rather than true adherence differences, which polypill should only matter for adherence or initiation and intensification. So we really wanted to test that hypothesis, and hence the emphasis on strong usual care pattern. And as you pointed out, the current rate of optimal GDMT use based on observational data is 15%, and we had 45-50%. So we did accomplish that to a large extent. The question about whether the difference in exposure is enough, I think it's a great question. And I think that's what we are learning. And I think definitely we need to do future studies to confirm these findings. At the end of the day, this is a start of this space. I think we have to do more studies and confirm these findings and test it in more multi-center fashion, where there would be heterogeneity by clinical practices in different sites. But I do think that the difference is compounded at two stages. One, the prescription was 30% higher on an absolute scale. And then there is a 50% difference in adherence. And we truly don't have a lot of data in heart failure literature about gold standard measured adherence and outcomes. I think a lot of the trials also, I don't know what their adherence of the drugs is when patients are sent home with pill bottles and how much do they take. So I do think the adherence difference of 50% is the clincher here, because that probably is what is manifesting into this high levels of difference. And I will say that both arms improved their EF decently. In a six-month follow-up, the usual care improved their EF by 6%. And then this was not all new onset heart failure. 50% of patients had chronic stable heart failure. Wow. So that delta tells you that uptitrating medications at any stage of heart failure makes a difference in improving the substrate function. But I think the adherence difference of 50% is, I think, what makes the outcomes, clinical outcomes, look so much more favorable for polypill.
I'd love to hear about safety, because here you're giving many therapies all at once. And while our friends have all discussed combination early use, even in recent or in-hospital use, we don't have too many trials like this where everything is given at once and you have an assessment of real-time safety. So first, how did you capture safety, and what were the safety results between arms?
Yeah, I think safety was paramount to us in terms of when we're designing the study, and we wanted to make sure that we don't cause harm with giving too much too soon. And that was also the reason why we kept the doses at lower levels for MRA, considering the hyperkalemia risk that can be compounded with ARNIs. And we didn't want it to limit use of other like ARNIs at high doses. So we did measure the usual adverse events for any heart failure trial. We looked at hyperkalemia risk. We looked at worsening of creatinine or kidney function by more than 30%. We looked at symptoms of dizziness, hypotension, and we looked at treatment discontinuation rates. So overall safety profile was very favorable. As you would expect, there was a little more hypotension and dizziness reported by patients. And in the polypill arm, there was no difference in hyperkalemia rates, and the overall hyperkalemia rates were low. And albeit we used 12.5 for spironolactone, we used an SGLT2 every time there was a spironolactone. So we did have measures in place that were lowering the risk of hyperkalemia. The AKI risk differences were also not significant. And the discontinuation rates were not as high either, and favorable for polypill compared to the usual care. So overall safety profile was very much in favor or comparable for the polypill versus the usual care for key serious adverse events.
Absolutely. I mean, super impressive. And again, I think the safety findings are arguably just as important in a way because, you know, again, there's so much hesitancy about starting multiple medicines at the same time. And I think, you know, you've just kind of...
Exactly. It just proves that...
Like strong HF, but even more, you know, urgent upfront.
Yeah, and strong didn't have SGLT2. So this is like a strong HF for a contemporary. And it just proves that Steve is right when he said that we need to start patients on therapy sooner and fast as we can, because if with right monitoring, obviously we had them very closely monitored, so with right amount of follow-up and monitoring, we can keep the adverse events in check, and you can actually get them on target doses or optimal doses sooner in a safe fashion.
Yeah, and I think just from like the clinical application of this, I mean, you showed about talked about how your usual care arm was like, you know, usual care plus, because you wanted to have, you know, really to demonstrate that efficacy. But if you could try to generalize this to real-world practice, where we know usual care is not usual care plus, it is true usual care where GDMT rates are low, but also that we generally follow the slow and steady approach where we are in no rush to get people on GDMT. I mean, these results would have potentially been even, you know, a more amazing.
Yeah, no.
Compared to a true usual care, which would have been a, you know, very low rate and slow.
That's exactly right. And Steve, you know, you're part of this, our next study that we're planning across multiple health systems to do a much larger study powered for clinical outcomes. And we do expect that if you compare it to the usual care, you are going to see more market difference. And I will say that as part of our implementation rigor and approach, we did do mixed methods work, and a subset of patients were interviewed in focus groups, and their family members were interviewed in a focus group as well, because we wanted to know what works for the polypill and what doesn't work when we stop the polypill after the trial completion. And patients really identified with the concept of this is their heart pill and they have to take it to keep their heart healthy. And a lot of the times patients have some subjective side effects and they stop all of it because they don't know what it is. And this time, because they associate so much more importance to that one pill, they wanted to keep taking it. And a lot of patients were not happy when we stopped the study, and they had to go off the polypill to back to like four pills. Right. And we got some really interesting feedback. We have the qualitative paper coming out in Circ Outcomes that came out today with the trial presentation as well. So it is a nice companion to what happened with the patients and how they see their heart failure care and what they prioritize when it comes to polypharmacy and polypills. And it was really eye-opening, and a lot of that is going into the larger study design that we are doing with multiple centers, including DCRI. So I think there's a lot to learn from this trial, and I will say that this is just a start, because we need to generate a lot more evidence across diverse settings, diverse patient populations, to really have the rigorous evidence to promote polypill as a potential therapeutic option for patients with heart failure. Mm-hmm.
A exciting, exciting advance. Congratulations, Ambrish. This is really opens the door to the future of heart failure. So thank you for joining us. And to our listeners, thank you. We will continue to bring you late-breaking news from the American Heart Association meeting and from upcoming meetings. And that wraps up this episode of Don't Miss a Beat. You can catch us and continue to follow us on HCP Live, as well as featured on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thank you very much.